For about 90% of America's history, we've had balanced budgets for the most part. Surprised? Well, after 2001, we kind of stopped doing that, and that's a problem, says my guest, Bill White, former CEO, now international banker, former mayor of Houston, and former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Energy, and author of the book, America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. This hour, we're going to talk about debt, why it's a problem, how it got to be one, and what can be done about it. Bill White, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
It's great to be with you.
So the question comes up, what would the founding fathers say if they were alive today, besides, gee, it's dark in here. But what would they say if they saw our budget? What was the original vision for how government ought to be financed and run?
Their vision was that you would only borrow for emergencies, not for routine operating expenses. And they had good reason to fear borrowing for routine operating expenses. You know, when Thomas Jefferson first heard of the Constitution, he had mixed feelings because he told his friend James Madison, who was the some people call the father of the Constitution, that it needed an amendment to restrict the use of debt. And why was that? Well, because for so many generations, Americans have wanted to create a better future for their kids and not leave them a big mortgage for their prior bills. And Jefferson was watching the French Revolution develop right in front of his eyes when a government was toppled because it couldn't pay its debt and the tax burden to pay for debt service had gotten so high. So this was very prominent in their minds.
Yeah, and I don't think most of us think about governments being being toppled or just ceasing to exist because they essentially go bankrupt. I mean, in the United States, that's just not an idea that was even thinkable prior to the debates over the debt ceiling here over the last few years. All of a sudden, people are talking about the United States defaulting on its debt. That was just an entirely new concept. So for most of us, it's just unthinkable that the government could be in jeopardy because we borrowed too much. We don't really pay attention to that. Why do you suppose we don't pay more attention to it?
Well, for one reason, in the United States, we were for so long, we were an outlier. We were an exception to the general rule. Actually, a lot of the European governments were sort of toppled or had big changes and defaulted on their debts. It would occur over the last couple of hundred years, but the United States was something different. People understood that if you borrowed money today, somebody would have to pay it back in the future. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to default on our debts, but I'll tell you what's happening, and I'll give you just a couple of facts and figures that flesh it out. According to official projections right now by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the amount that we pay each year for debt service, interest on prior debts, is scheduled to triple in the next 10 years. It'll go from about $415 billion today to over $1.2 trillion. Now, you know, that's a lot of zeros, but that is equivalent to, $10,000 per year per American household just to pay interest on the debt. And where we see that is that more of each dollar we pay in federal income taxes is paid to service old debts and less is available for everything else.
Is a part of that connected to the fact that we have so many people these days who are working for a lot less money and therefore paying a lot less in taxes, and so there's the cash flow coming into the Treasury is less. Is that at least a part of this?
Well, it may be, but the revenues are now as high as they've ever been. Part of it has been that we accumulated debts. Since 2001, we balanced the budget in 2000, but 2001, we've borrowed money for a combination of extraordinary expenses of the nature that we used to borrow for, such as wars or during severe recessions. Plus, we've been borrowing to pay for routine expenses. And I'll give you an example. In 2003, at the initiative of the Bush administration, but with bipartisan support, we added a prescription drug benefit to Medicare, but there was no plan other than borrowing on how to pay for it. Well, now the baby boomers have become eligible for Medicare, the first in 2010, and the number of people over 85 is predicted to triple by 2030. Older people have more acute medical needs, and we don't have the money to pay for it. That's one of the principal drivers. And, of course, there were other exceptional things that have occurred since 2000. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were the first in the nation's history when the nation did not raise taxes to defray the cost of debt incurred for war. And in the past, people believed that and the public understood and people in both parties understood that civilians should be willing to bear some of the sacrifices if we were going to send our sons and daughter over to fight for the country. If it was worth sacrificing lives, it was certainly worth paying far more in taxes and not entirely with debt. But we departed from that rule.
Well, not only did we not have a war tax, which, by the way, I think Congressman Dave Obie proposed a surtax like the one for the Vietnam War.
Correct.
We not only did not have a war tax, we had a huge tax cut in the middle of the war.
That's right. And, you know, that would have been considered outright unpatriotic in the past. And in a long term, if you're going to have a war on terrorism, it has to be sustainable. It's not as though you're going to have one big battle and there's not going to be organized groups intent on doing harm that are organizing, you know, all over the world. So if you're going to be more vigilant on the threat of terrorism, it has to be a sustained effort. So it's not a temporary effort. And any family or any business knows that if you have continuing sustained expenses, you pay for that out of revenues, not out of debt.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking with Bill White, author of the book America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. Invite you to join the conversation. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. is the email address, and you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. The title of your book is America's Fiscal Constitution. There isn't actually a written version of this signed by men wearing white wigs and so forth.
Right.
There isn't one of these, but when you talk about the fiscal constitution, what are you speaking of?
Well, you know, we've always had a unwritten constitution in addition to the written constitution, just like Great Britain. As a matter of fact, at the time of the Revolution, one of the big beefs of the colonists was that Great Britain was not abiding by the unwritten constitution. That's what they called it. It was the norms and established traditions by which they lived, one of which is if you're going to be taxed, you ought to have representation in Parliament. And there's other features of the fiscal constitution as described in my book. The two-party system, or the whole concept of parties, is now deeply embedded in American election law, psychology, and everything else. But there's nothing about that in the Constitution. I'll tell you, Franklin Roosevelt found out a big time about the informal constitution in 1937 when he proposed to change the number of people on the Supreme Court because he didn't like the way that it was ruling. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that Congress can't change the number of people on the Supreme Court. Actually, it had done so in the prior century. But the idea that you would change it because you didn't like the ruling violated a deep sense of the way that the American system should work. Similarly, for 180 years, this country only borrowed for four purposes. It only borrowed to expand its territory, to fight wars, to offset loss of revenues and provide relief during downturns, and to prevent states from leaving the Union. And it never borrowed simply to pay for routine operating expenses. That is something that's fairly new.
Well, and not to get too far into the weeds here on this, but prior to the establishment of a federal income tax, the federal government basically had been financed on what, tariffs and excise taxes,
right.
on liquor and things like that.
Yeah, and imports. Of course, the federal government. So those were the type of taxes that financed it. They instituted an income tax during the Civil War when they needed more money, and since 1917, the beginning of World War One, the corporate and personal income taxes have been pulling the largest load in the federal budget.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. So we spent a great deal of our history up till now balancing budgets, and you provide a very interesting graph or chart in your book showing year by year what the federal surplus or deficit was right from the very beginning of the Republic. Very informative. At what point did we decide that it was okay to start borrowing for purposes other than things like war or some other economic emergency?
Well, you know, this is one of the interesting things that I sought to, you know, try to investigate in detail and document because it occurred very quietly. In 2000, leaders in both parties were actually vying for credit for the fact that we had balanced the budget, and both deserve some credit. It had been a goal, you know, the vast majority of American public in the period of in the prior quarter century had backed a constitutional amendment to balance a budget that reduced the demands of the federal government on credit markets, so that resulted in a lowering of interest rates. And nobody campaigned in 2000 on the platform of, you know, let's start borrowing money in order to pay for routine expenses. But in the years 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, spending went up, revenues went down. We had large tax cuts without spending cuts. We had large spending increases without any question of where it would be paid from. And unlike what occurred in the early years of the Reagan administration, after the first year of the Reagan administration, both the president and Congress and leaders in both parties, they all acknowledged and admitted that the deficit was a big problem. And almost every year they did something, cut some kind of spending, raise some taxes in order to try to lower that deficit. After 2001, when the larger deficit appeared, then they spent more and cut taxes again.
800-642-1234. Phone calls starting to come in. Let's tell you what. Let's take a. Here's a question. We got an email. Let's do this first. We have an email from David in Ironwood. Great question. David wonders, who do we owe this debt to? Who's holding? Who's holding all our paper?
Great question. There's one unusual aspect of the debt today, which didn't exist before 2001, and that is that now, more than ever before in the nation's history, a lot of that debt, some $3 trillion, is owed to foreign creditors. So when the debt interest rates go up, debt service goes up, we're making payments to the Saudis, and the Chinese central bank is the largest holder of that debt. And it's also held by financial institutions, insurance companies, banks. Relatively little is held by individuals, which is a change from what occurred after World War II when an immense amount of the debt was held in the form of savings bonds that had been marketed to the general public. And here's an important point. Some folks who've been listening to this show, or you may have heard of a best-selling book by a French professor, Thomas Piketty, on income inequality. It was, you know, one of the few economics books to make the bestseller list. And Professor Piketty points out, he would be an unabashed, I guess you'd call it, liberal. And he's concerned about income inequality. And he points out that in the past, liberals were very suspicious of federal debt because basically what it did is it earmarked a larger and larger percentage of tax revenues to be paid to creditors. And the creditors, by and large, were wealthy people and corporations.
Yeah, and that certainly has become the case. We've got some phone calls, we've got some other things to do, and more questions. When we come back, Bill White, I want to talk specifically about what's wrong with having some debt. And some people have said, don't worry about it, we'll pay it off later. But let's talk about what the real problem is here, why this is a big deal, and why it's so important that we're talking about it today. 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, and the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, all great ways to get in touch and have your say this hour here on the IdeasNet. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Bill White this hour, the author of the book America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. Bill White is a former CEO, now an international banker, a former mayor of Houston, and the former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Energy. When we talk about this debt, some people like to say, well, you know, how much does this really matter? Yeah, we borrowed money, but, you know, who's going to call in our notes? I mean, we're too big to fail. What's the real problem with debt? Where are we going to, at what point are we in really serious trouble with it, or have we already crossed that threshold?
Well, there's sort of a quantitative or numerical answer and a qualitative answer. The numerical answer is debt becomes excessive when it's too large in relationship to the revenues that you have to pay for the debt and service the debt. So a little bit of debt that's used for an emergency that's repaid is not bad. If it's a serious emergency, you might borrow more, and it takes you longer to pay it down. That's the pattern of American history after wars or severe economic downturns. But today, the total debt is about 9 times the ability of the federal revenues, principally from income taxes, that are legally able to service that debt. I mean, we can't use, it's not legal, and it wouldn't be right if we used people's Medicare premiums or Social Security contributions to service that debt, so it's the income taxes. And what that means is that more and more of each dollar in federal revenue will go to pay for old bills, and less will be able to pay for everything else. Either that, or you continue to compound interest, and nobody can beat compound interest. Compound interest will you know, eat you alive. The blessing for the saver, the reason why somebody could put away a couple of $1,000s a year in an IRA, and if they get a 6 or 7% return, have $500,000 by the time they retire, that works against somebody who's a debtor. But there's also one other point, and it's a moral issue. It's an ethical issue. And that is, often debt shouldn't be used to disguise the cost of government in a way that, you know, creates unsustainable levels of spending. If people should expect to pay for the level of government services that they want to receive, and if they're unwilling to pay for it, then it's not free by using debt. It's really a matter of creating a better future for our kids and our grandkids. Americans have, you know, always understood that. Actually, liberals, progressives, believe that in order to preserve the future, we should balance the budget so that there's more opportunity for folks on the way up. And conservatives agreed for a different reason. Conservatives believe that if you wanted to have a smaller government, relatively smaller government, you should make clear to the public the cost of new programs expressed in taxes. As a result, there was a great bipartisan consensus that we should reserve borrowing for emergencies and not just for routine expenses.
Let's take some phone calls here. We'll start in Milwaukee, where John is waiting. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's interesting to have an international banker on the program talking about money and debt. But Congress was granted the power to create money, coin money, and regulate the value of it, not the Federal Reserve Bank. And that's sort of the side subject. And first of all, question, just a simple question. What is our federal debt right now? Is it used to be $17 trillion a couple years ago or 4 years ago?
Yeah, it's about $17.5 trillion.
Okay.
Which is, to give you a sense of that, maybe $140,000 per household in the United States.
But hasn't gone much up in the last three years or 4 years.
It has gone up. I mean, that number, 3 years ago would have been $14 billion. $14 trillion. Gosh, when we start talking about these, we're talking about $1 trillion.
But it's a little bit about our age.
In this fiscal year, right now, the government is on a fiscal year, John, that begins on October 1. And in this fiscal year, this 12-month spending period that we're now, in the sixth inning of here in June, they will borrow about $700 billion to pay for the routine expenses of government. And that's with the tax policy and spending policy that has been approved by a Republican House and a Democratic Senate.
And all of those congressmen and the president, they've all been subsidized by vested interests. So they're all working for the corporations and the bankers. So that's why they pass these debt-creating bills. And that's why
I think one reason they do it is there's a gap between what they promised voters and the resources that are available within the federal government. The people call themselves conservatives. And they say, well, we want to lower taxes or extend these taxes. Just last week, there was some tax breaks that were passed by the House. But in the old days, the conservatives, when they lowered taxes, felt obligated to lower spending. And they're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, and it's just gotten to be kind of interesting which things various factions within Congress are willing to spend money on without having to offset them. So the proposal was to permanently extend corporate tax breaks, but there was no offset. And yet in the Senate, a veterans bill was blocked because the people proposing it hadn't found a way to pay for it. So it's gotten to be a real political game, and it just seems like no one's even using real numbers anymore. It makes it really hard to understand because there is no real coherent or bipartisan effort to do anything in Congress in 2014. That's really a big part of the problem right now, isn't it?
Yeah, although partisanship itself, it's hard to blame that because, well, I'll give you an example from the book. After the Civil War, I'll tell you, people in the two parties hated each other. They each blamed the other for a war that had, resulted in the deaths of a substantial portion of the population. Every family had some death that was Civil War related. And the Democrats said that it was Republican intransigence, and the Republicans called the Democrats the traitor party or the rebel party, and they wouldn't have much to do with each other. But they both agreed that it was important for the future of the country to pay down debt from the Civil War, and they proceeded to do it. And so we see this time and time in history. You could recall Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich couldn't agree on hardly anything, except they both did agree in 1995 that we ought to try to balance the budget. They had different plans to do that, and they duked it out in a public forum, and eventually we did get to a balanced budget. So it's hard to blame partisanship as such, but there has been a change. The liberals used to believe, and progressives generally, that you needed to sustain funding of public programs with taxation. And if the taxes were cut, you cut spending and then, fought it out in the next election and blamed that cut on the other party. Conservatives used to believe that you restrain the growth of government by making sure that taxes covered the cost of government rather than making it appear that government was free by selling it on the installment plan. And that has changed.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. John, thanks for your call. Let's go to Eau Claire next, where Lars is on the line. Lars, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with everything your guest says, but I'm just wondering if there really is a way out of this. I mean, I think if our economy doesn't grow, there isn't enough money in the system to service the debt anyway. If the government doesn't keep on deficit spending, we're going to default on everything anyway, aren't we?
I don't think so. I mean, America has grown many times in the past, including the late 1990s when we balanced the budget. We did it for two decades when the economy prospered after World War II. We did it for 55 years after the Civil War, where they, except for a few years during a downturn, we never borrowed money. Actually, when you borrow money, what that does is it tends to drive interest rates up. So, my friend Lloyd Benson said a few years back in a famous vice presidential debate that anybody can, create the illusion of prosperity by writing a hot check. But that's not long-term prosperity. Long-term prosperity depends on the productivity of the workforce. And that's a whole, other set of issues. It depends on an increasing population. It doesn't depend on how much money, the government does not finance long-term prosperity by borrowing money.
Ultimately, is it possible for the government to say, okay, well, we owe this money, we'll just print more?
Yes, you can do that. You can do some of that, and some of it has been done over the last several years up to a limit. And the limit is called inflation. So in my book, I very carefully document the amount of what I call monetized debt, that is debt that is, in the old days, they would just print new currency, and then the Federal Reserve, after the days of the Federal Reserve would buy government debt and issue new currency or credit in exchange, which is what they've been doing. And you can do that up to a point. But you can't do it excessively. Otherwise, there's the cruelest tax of all, and that's inflation.
800-642-1234. Let's go to Ann in Madison next. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I think the simple answer is over the last 40 years or so, the very, very rich have managed to bribe our politicians, let's call it these things what they are, going offshore, as they say, that is, chartered their businesses somewhere other than the United States or somewhere other than the state they actually operate in, which may have high corporate taxes. As a result, they're not contributing in many cases anything to our either national or state tax bases. And the reaction of the reactionaries, I don't call them conservatives, is to say, okay, we don't have enough money even to keep these cities going. We can't possibly do anything other than cut services like Social Security and Medicare and all these things that people with very little money really rely on. So this is a hoax, I think.
Mm-hmm. It is the caller has makes a point, refers to a fact that I talk about in the book. I may draw a little different conclusion, but it is just a fact that after World War II, because the United States accounted for half the entire world economy, 80% of the industrial goods, then our corporate income tax paid for a much higher percentage of government than it does today. What happened? The principal thing that happened was that Europe recovered from the devastation of two world wars. East Asia developed. More of the underdeveloped countries became developed. You had countries like Korea and Singapore who went from destitution to being, you know, having a deep middle class. And we had much more competition with American corporations. And corporations became more global. So corporations can decide to invest wherever they can get the highest return in the world. There's really not much you can do to stop that. If you tried to stop that entirely, corporations would just move their headquarters outside the United States. So, but we never found a source of substitution for those revenues, and that became a real problem.
And thanks for the call. Here is a comment on Facebook. Jerry Ann from South Milwaukee emailed what she calls her three-step plan to reduce the deficit. And in a moment, Bill White, we should probably clarify the difference between the deficit and the debt. But here's Jerry Ann's plan. One, impose a post-Iraq-Afghanistan war tax on every American except those who served in the U.S. military during those two wars and their immediate families. Two, require those who can to pay for Medicare to do so. And three, end government subsidies to corporations. What do you think of her plan?
I think I would love to see a public debate on the first plank of her plan because, we say during Memorial Day and Veterans Day, and I've done it and I said it myself as a reminder that freedom isn't free, that there's people who've served and sacrificed so much for our country and we have an obligation to our veterans. And I think people would be willing to pay for that obligation if they were asked to pay for that obligation. So I'd like to see a good public debate on that. There are we could go back and forth on what's called a corporate subsidy. Let me just say that by and large, the size of those is very small compared to the amount of borrowing that the United States does. And there's usually the reason some of them are, venal special interest loopholes, and generally those are the ones that are relatively small in size. Others are designed to enhance the competitive of American businesses, and they've had bipartisan support, which is particularly important at a time that we won't want to have jobs.
Thanks, Jerry Ann, for that for your contribution to the program. Let's go next to Lou in Oconomowoc. Lou, thanks for joining us.
Hi, I was calling. My biggest concern is that we as individuals out here are pretty much trumped by the people in Washington, lobbyists who are approaching. Our voices have just disappeared. The people that are writing the laws there are people that got big money. America's just null and void out here. I mean, we had and this was under President Clinton. Glass-Steagall got repealed, led to just an absolute raiding of this country's wealth and, people's 401s and homes. And, just opened the banks up for everything. And the very people that are writing these laws are the ones that are raiding us. And the middle class is getting so hollowed out here, we're just barely hanging on. We're underwriting the oil companies to this day. They're making money hand over foot. Again, last year, with troops, I've got a nephew, still in the service, troops overseas were the same week or week after that they've devoted to combat pay increased from $225 to $325 a week was denied. A week later, though, we had government subsidies again for these oil companies. You know, you want to talk about something that flies in the face of just patriotism and all this other stuff. The people up there on Capitol Hill, they stand there and they pose for holy pictures and pretend we're not seeing it out here. And you know what? I'm just the little guy out here, but I see it. But my voice means nothing because they still have these lobbyists and the big money out there, which has been given personhood now, corporations. It's a whole other situation.
Lou, I want to let Bill White respond to what you're saying, and then we need to get to a break. Thanks for calling.
Well, it's interesting. The comment that Lou made is similar to something I remember that occurred about 22 years ago when we had a couple of folks running for office, which I think history will treat pretty well as being solid presidents, George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. And, you know, compared to some others who've held that office. They both said they wanted to balance a budget, didn't propose a concrete plan to do so. And here comes Ross Perot. Now, you know, I know Mr. Perot, and I'm not sure that he's exactly out of the personality mold that we'd want as a president. But he did warn of the influence of these lobbyists, and he did warn of the threat of foreign competition, and he did warn about what we would do if we continued to borrow money. And when he soared to the lead in the presidential polls, then you saw both political parties get in line and get more serious about balancing the budget. I hope that there are reformers inside or outside the parties who can help us return to that day.
Lou, again, thanks for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and have more of our conversation with Bill White, author of the book America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. By the way, Kathleen will be back on Monday. And Monday afternoon at this time, she'll be talking with the filmmakers of Ivory Tower as tuition rates skyrocket beyond the reach and student loan debt reaches into the trillions. This documentary asks the question, is college worth it anymore? That's Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock on the Kathleen Dunn Show. This hour, we're talking with Bill White, former CEO and former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Energy, and author of the book America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll start in Sparta, where Matt is with us. Matt, hello.
Hi there. So hey, your guest had kind of alluded to the point where he said the federal government hadn't borrowed against Social Security to this point. Maybe I misunderstood him, but if not, it was my understanding that they had borrowed from Social Security, and that's why we're concerned, you know, when we retire, there's not going to be any Social Security.
Yeah, and to clarify this, I said that's an excellent point, and I'm glad you brought it up, Matt, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about it. You cannot legally use the payroll taxes to service debt, that is to pay debt service. What has been done is the United States has borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund, and that's part of the $17.5 trillion in debt that I described earlier. Now, that's a real debt. It's a real claim on future income tax revenues that we owe. And that whole there's a real problem with federal accounting that was used to disguise this debt, and let me explain what happened. Franklin Roosevelt and Republicans, so it was both the progressives and Republicans, agreed in the 1930s that we should keep Social Security apart from the rest of the federal budget, and it should be separately accounted for because they needed to use what's called actuarial accounting. So when you take in a dollar of a payroll contribution, you treat that as a premium, and then you record a liability because you're going to have to pay a pension out later on. In 1969, the federal government combined the Social Security with the rest of the budget. It was called the unified budget. But that led to consistent misstatements of the federal finances. And because when they started accumulating a surplus for the retirement of baby boomers after 1983, they counted that income with the federal government, but they didn't record the corresponding liability. It'd be like if a corporation out there had a pension fund for the workers, and instead of keeping the pension fund separate, they recorded the income and their revenues and profits that they reported to shareholders, but they didn't report the fact that the company had a liability that was associated to the retirees. That is made illegal under that would violate all sorts of federal laws if a company did that. The federal government does it routinely.
Matt, thanks for that call and clarifying that for us. Let's go to Weyerhaeuser next, and Rod is with us. Rod, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Interesting program here. I can't remember. It was one of the debates, if it was Ross Perot when he was in with Clinton and George Sr., and they had mentioned about Reagan, that up until the and I'm not pointing fingers at Reagan, but anyhow, I'm just saying that they said we had a debt where supposedly we owed ourselves money. We didn't have a foreign debt. But after Reagan's term was done, I was just wondering if that was the case, that we didn't we have a foreign debt? And how significant is that like affecting us today, if that was true or not? I don't know.
Beginning in the 1970s and continuing through the 1980s, then there would be foreign debt holders, but it really exploded in the period 2001 through 2004, the foreign debt holders. As a matter of fact, we had vast amounts of borrowing during that period, during the first term of the Bush administration, and almost all of that money was borrowed from either the trust funds of the federal government, like military retirement, Social Security, and other trust funds, or foreign governments. And I'll tell you what was going on. This gets a little complicated, and you will not hear this from incumbent politicians in either political party. But here it goes. China was trying to increase its exports. In order to increase its exports, then it wanted to keep the value of its currency low relative to the dollar. They were being paid for those exports with dollar. And in the normal course of normal trade, what that would do would tend to increase the value of the Chinese currency, and so there would be the Chinese goods that were exported to the United States would be more expensive. The Chinese government knew this, and so what it did is when dollars were sent to Chinese firms for these exports, the Chinese government took in those dollars, gave them Chinese currency, and then took the dollars and invested them in our treasury bills, in our treasury bonds as well. Now, why do I mention that? The federal debt has had a direct role in subsidizing Chinese exports to the United States, and no economist would disagree with what I just said. And so it sort of makes me mad when I hear, people in Congress, complaining about Chinese exports and the threat of China when they have been briefed numerous times on the fact that the more this nation borrows and allows foreign government to invest back in our treasury, that tends to, what do you call, strengthen the dollar. And makes imports into this country cheaper.
Let's take another call quickly from Julie in Northfield, and we're starting to get to the end of the hour, Julie. So I'll ask you to be brief. Go ahead.
Okay. Hello.
Yes, go ahead,
Julie.
I was wondering one objection he had to taxing the very rich to help with the debt, the national debt, because where else is the money going to come from to eliminate that?
Okay, Julie, let's have Bill White answer that question. Do we need to go back maybe to the tax rates of the Eisenhower administration?
Well, not really, Alex. First of all, I think that it was a good move to raise the tax rates on the wealthy Americans back to where they were in the Clinton administration. That was accomplished at the end of 2012, and the Medicare taxes were also increased. So now, all in, people in the highest bracket are paying about 42%. If you start pushing it much higher than that, however, then you'll see what you did see in the Eisenhower administration, which is people will shelter their income, or they won't take capital gains. They won't realize capital gains.
But capital gains taxes are capped at 15%, aren't they? So, I mean, if most of your income comes from capital gains, you're not paying 42%.
No, you're not paying 42%, although they did increase the capital gains tax on those with the on the various highest income. But if you start increasing that capital gains tax, then people will what we call defer taking their capital gains. What we saw by the end of the Eisenhower administration, I'm saying people in both parties saw this, that very few people were actually paying the top tax rate.
So let's take one more call. This time we'll go to Wautoma. Douglas is with us. Douglas, hello.
Hello, how are you? My question is simple. With the $17.5 trillion in the national debt we're always hearing about, we never hear anything about the unfunded liability, which is in excess of $100 trillion. Why is that?
Well, you've heard about it, and if for those who read my book, they'll see that the biggest component of that, as you well know, is Medicare, and that's what we're facing. The politicians were watching it. It was like watching a train wreck in slow motion. They saw that in 2010, when the baby boomers would begin to retire, I mean, that's 75 million Americans. That's over a fifth of the population is in this huge baby boom generation born between 45 and 65. And when they began to retire, then that was going to impose a huge burden on the federal budget. With Social Security, in 1983, they did something about it. They pushed back the retirement age for full benefits. They created a reserve for the retirement of baby boomers. But on Medicare, nothing was done about it. And that is a huge issue facing us today. What I call for in the book is, you know, you may have listeners on this show that are all over the political spectrum, but I think most Americans, whatever they believe, would agree that it doesn't make any sense to borrow money to pay for Medicare, that we ought to put Medicare on a pay-as-you-go system. If so-called conservatives say, okay, let's cut back Medicare by 40% so that it's covered by the existing contributions, payroll taxes, premiums, okay, let them try that and see what happens during the next election. But it's also progressives shouldn't say, well, listen, we preserve Medicare. They won't preserve Medicare until we get a permanent source of financing for it.
So we've got about a minute and a half left of the program, which isn't anywhere near enough time. But give us the short version of what you think we absolutely must do in order to fix this problem.
Well, we need folks that are active in both political parties or a third party to make this a voting issue. If somebody says that there's easy choices out there, then you probably know that they're pulling your leg and trying to sell you something.
Of course, Walter Mondale said that in 1984, and look what it got him.
Yeah, but I will say, you know, there were other reasons for Mr. Mondale's loss in that election, and part of the entire book is to show that how many generations of politicians made tough choices in order to balance the budget and were consistently reelected. I think it could happen again.
All right. Bill White, thanks so much for joining us today. Bill White is a former CEO, now international banker, former mayor of Houston, and author of the book America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley. We had on-air production from Dave Potratz and Jennifer Dargan today. Kathleen will be back next Monday, and she'll be talking with the filmmakers of Ivory Tower. That's coming up Monday at 2 o'clock. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You've been listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.